Next item on the agenda is item number 7, James and June Harvey, 080059.
Morning, Mr. Bowman, members of the commission.
Morning, Jay.
This item is a commission review of the Chesapeake Wetland Board action last month to approve, after the fact, 133-foot long retaining wall, timber bulkhead, and backfill associated with an unauthorized artificial putting green, resulting in 850 square feet of wetland loss at property on the southern branch in Chesapeake. I have, I believe, four slides by way of orientation for the commission that were not part of the record, and in keeping with past practices, I would ask that you be allowed to view those without considering it opening the record.
Orientation purposes?
Yes, sir.
Correct.
Good old Google Earth. This is the southern branch of the Elizabeth River, I-64 high-rise bridge, and the Great Bridge locks, and the Great Bridge, right here. This is the Riverwalk subdivision in which the Harveys live. Our Vigen aerials, a little bit closer view showing the extensive marsh. This is Mr. Harvey's pier, proceeding up to his residence, their residence. And one last shot there. Again, these were taken in 2002 prior to the installation of the unauthorized structure. Flew this last week, and again, the Harvey Pier, the marsh, a mix of Spartina and Phragmites going up to the upland, and this is the structure, subject structure, in which the Wetlands Board took an action. And one last shot looking banked hard over, straight down. This is the artificial putting green and retaining wall slash bulkhead structure. As you'll see from your packet, it's a fairly extensive record. There is actually about a year-long history with this project that involves both Chesapeake Bay Preservation Area violations as well as wetland violations. I have limited the record to just those actions related to the Wetlands Board jurisdiction and hearing. I have put a one-page letter that we received yesterday from Mr. James R. Harvey III, representing his father, that indicates that the record that was prepared for you all may not be complete. You'll see that I circled item 2 and item 6, which he indicates are not part of the record. In fact, they are in your record. 1, 3, 4, 5, and 7 are not part of the record that staff prepared for you, but we do not believe it's part of the Chesapeake Bay Wetlands Board portion of it, rather the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act Board. They're one and the same board. They hear items concurrently at their meetings, but they deal with different jurisdictional areas. So I do have that information here in a packet. I believe the information that is pertinent to the board's jurisdiction, the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction, is in your packet, and I can let them make their case if they don't believe that to be so. As I said, there's some history here. Going back to essentially December of last year, there was a violation hearing that the Wetlands Board heard on this particular bulkhead, this bulkhead built into the marsh. There was information presented at that hearing. That's the minutes of that are item 5 in your packet. That was not the Wetlands Board approval of this project, but that was their review of the violation that led to the submittal of the after-the-fact application for review. I'm hoping this is less confusing than the last issue.
We'll get that one straightened out.
Okay. Getting to the background, essentially the Chesapeake City staff made an inspection of the site at 701 River Strand back in March of 2007 as a result of a complaint of a Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act violation building within the buffer area. That inspection revealed that there was, in fact, the Bay Act violation, and later review of their records indicated that the bulkhead retaining wall that's in the wetland and buffer area was also not authorized, therefore it's a wetland violation. Review of the records of the property indicate an application was submitted in 1997, for a pier, private pier, which was reviewed by this agency as well as the Chesapeake Bay, the City of Chesapeake Wetlands Board and Building Department. All permits were granted that were necessary for that pier structure, but there was no bulkhead associated with that application. As I mentioned, a show cause hearing was held December 19th. During the hearing, the staff presented their report to the board. There's a timeline, many site photographs, some of which you'll see in the subsequent slides. The board found that a wetland violation had indeed occurred, that there was, in fact, unauthorized fill of 850 square feet of vegetated wetlands, and assessed a civil charge of $2,000, to which Mr. Harvey agreed, and I believe has paid that fine. At that meeting, the city staff recommended that either the bulkhead, the unauthorized structure, be removed, or that the Harveys submit an after-the-fact application to try to get authorization to retain that structure, which is what they did. On January 11th, VMRC received that application, forwarded on to the board. The first hearing on the project by the Chesapeake Wetlands Board was on February 20th of 2008. At that hearing, city staff reported a lot of the same information that they had in their violation hearing, show cause hearing in December. And at that time, the board was presented a letter by Mr. Jim Bradford, one of the representatives of Mr. Harvey, Mr. and Mrs. Harvey, asking for a deferral for 30 days to be able to gather some additional information, presumably. In addition, Mr. Brent Nielsen, the director of planning on behalf of the city manager, asked the board to continue the matter for 30 days so that they could look at how the city staff was handling this violation internally to make sure everything was being done properly to afford the Harveys an opportunity to legally retain the structure. The matter was therefore unanimously continued until the March 2008 meeting. This is where we start with the slides. Again, some of these slides were presented in previous meetings, but this is part of the March 19th, 2008 public hearing in which the action was rendered. Ground shots showing the structure. This is obviously the vegetated wetlands out here. This is an artificial surface, AstroTurf similar. Not sure what number hole that is there. A little sand trap over here, again, looking, I guess, west or downriver. The Phragmites dominated vegetated wetlands. Just some detail showing the structure. This is the return wall going back into the upland, adjacent property here. Looking now back across the putting green. I don't know if I should leave anything up there. I'll just leave it there for now. Again, on March 19th, city staff provided background information with a reminder or an overview of Section 28.2.13.10 and 13.13 of the Code of Virginia, reminding the board that any of their decisions or all of their decisions are subject to review by VMRC and citizen if there's a petition that would potentially look at how they handled the project. They also provided a summary report and matrix that provided a history of the wetlands and CBPA violations or issues at the property. They presented the VIMS report, which it was dated February 12, 2008. That's actually in your packet if you want to turn to it, 411. The VIMS report states, and I quote, "Subject property is currently protected by an expansive fringe marsh and therefore should not require additional structural shoreline protection. We do not recommend the use of bulkheads in this shoreline setting and would not have recommended this approach had we reviewed it prior to construction," end quote. After presenting the findings of the project, that it resulted in impacts to 850 square feet of type 12 brackish water wetlands with no anticipated public or private benefit, Their staff, city staff, recommended denial of the application. They further recommended removal of the bulkhead and backfill within 30 days, as well as restoration of the disturbed wetlands thereunder. Board then went into the public hearing. Speaking in opposition to the project was Mr. Ellis W. James, who agreed with the staff recommendation for denial and stated that he believed this was an egregious violation of the wetland zoning ordinance. There were five speakers in favor of the project, including Mr. Harvey, his son, Jim Harvey III, a neighbor, Mr. Pesca, the engineering consultant who I mentioned before, Mr. Bradford, and the agent for the application, the wetlands application, Mr. Doug Davis. Testimony from these individuals included the confusion related to the permitting requirements for the structure, approval of the homeowners association for the structure, benefit of the fill in the bulkhead covering existing construction debris at the site, structural integrity of the retaining wall, which was questioned earlier during the violation hearing, whether or not the structure was even structurally sound, and the offer of mitigation at a ratio of 1-to-1 for the lost wetland resource. Mr. Harvey III questioned how the agenda was framed. The assistant city attorney, Ms. Dana Sanford, indicated that staff had framed the agenda logically given the related wetlands and CBPA violations. Again, at the Chesapeake Wetlands Board meetings, it's the same board. They handle their wetlands issues, and then they basically switch hats and become the Chesapeake Preservation Act Board and hear other issues that may or may not be related to one another. Mr. Bradford stated that allowing the improvements to remain in place was beneficial since the wetlands proffered or offered as mitigation are of a higher value, i.e. their Spartina marsh that was created in a bank in Chesapeake rather than the filled Phragmites-dominated marsh. He also stated the area acts as a BMP since the surface is pervious and therefore improves water quality. Mr. Bradford further stated the bulkhead is really more of a retaining wall to protect the landscaping from saltwater intrusion during storm events every 10 years or so. Member Cahoon stated the existing tidal wetlands would offer a buffer to the property from any erosion, wave erosion. Mr. Davis disagreed with the findings. Mr. Doug Davis, agent for the application, disagreed with the findings in the staff report, stated that the wetlands impacted are not type 12 but type 7 Phragmites wetlands. He spoke at length on the relative benefits of both types of wetlands, and he explained that restoration of the area would result in just more Phragmites, and that with the mitigation offer, allowing the project to remain would result in both alterniflora wetlands that's offered as a mitigation and the functional BMP. Mr. Harvey then addressed the board on his own behalf. He reiterated the 1-to-1 mitigation offer and said that restoring the wetlands on site would have less public benefit than the wetlands purchased in the mitigation bank which was being offered. He said that there are other bulkheads in the area and that his bulkhead is not for wave action but to protect the backyard from saltwater intrusion. Mr. Harvey said that he was told by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers where to build his pier and that a city inspector told him that permits for piers always include bulkheads. If you don't mind, I'm going to break real quick. I have some additional information that was submitted to the board that you should see, especially since I just referenced other bulkheads in the area. Information presented by city staff, basically a timeline of the property starting in 1995 going through 2005. That was in their attempt to determine when the Kathy, I don't think you can hear me. That diagram. That diagram is a representation of the subject property through aerial imagery that shows the boundaries of the parcel over time. Well, the boundaries don't change. The parcel over time from 95 to 2005, that was staff's attempt to determine when the structure was put in. These three next images were presented by the agent, Mr. Harvey's agent for the project, and I don't know if there's a particular order,
harder to see. Essentially, the same lots
along that reach of shoreline with Mr. Harvey's lot indicated in bold, showing his pier, a little bit blurry. This is really the one that... This is the diagram a lot of time was spent on, showing the outline of the structures along the shoreline and the parcel boundaries. That being the subject property of Mr. Harvey, and that was when Mr. Harvey indicated there are other bulkheads along the shoreline. And this last, I believe, that's actually from the city site, an oblique aerial photograph that was presented both in previous Bay Act hearings, but as well was presented by the applicant's agent showing the parcel. So after Mr. Harvey testified, Chairman Lane commented that if this application were brought before the board before it was built, that staff would have advised the applicant to pull the bulkhead back to the wetland's edge. Mr. Davis stated he would expect that to be the case and would not even bring an application in like that for approval before the fact. The public hearing portion of the meeting was closed after approximately 90 minutes. Following the public hearing, the board deliberated in open session, discussion amongst themselves. They discussed at length the after-the-fact nature of the request, the relative value of the existing impacted Phragmites wetlands at the site compared to the alternate flora wetlands at the bank for which the applicant was offering mitigation, the ratio of mitigation credits being offered, confusion surrounding the construction of the bulkhead and pier, previous action of the board during the violation hearing and finding a violation had occurred and the civil charge requirement therein. After discussion, Member Hinch voted to approve the request with mitigation at a ratio of 2.5 to 1 for the 850 square feet of impacted wetlands. That motion failed for lack of a second. Member Ottinger then moved to approve the project with a mitigation at a ratio of 1.5 to 1 for the 850 square feet of impact, which results in $15,300 to purchase 1,275 square feet of credit at the going rate of $12 per square foot at the bank in Chesapeake, at the mitigation bank. Member Ketchmark seconded the motion, and it passed 5-2. With Chairman Lane and Member Hinch voting against the motion. That concludes my discussion. I hesitate to read verbatim the summary and recommendations, but put a little time into writing it, so I think I'm going to stick with it as much as I can. Commission staff was present at the February hearing in which it was deferred, at the March hearing in which a decision was rendered, as well as the December hearing, the show cause violation hearing. It's clear from the record that the bulkhead slash retaining wall and artificial putting green are not water dependent. There is no active detrimental erosion at the site, and that 850 square feet of jurisdictional title vegetated wetlands were filled without prior proper approval. While arguments were made that the wetlands impacted were of lesser value than those wetlands offered to be purchased in a mitigation bank, staff does not believe this is adequate justification for authorizing unnecessary non-water-dependent development in tidal wetlands. The board clearly felt that the structure would not have been approved as it currently exists had they had an opportunity to review it ahead of time. The board seemed to be persuaded to accept the compensatory mitigation under the assumption that restoration of the area would result in wetlands of lesser value without first considering removal of the structure that would not have been permitted in the first place in that location. Based on the foregoing, staff believes that the decision of the Chesapeake Wetlands Board to grant after-the-fact approval of the application is unsupported by the evidence on the record considered as a whole. In addition, staff believes their decision fails to prevent the despoliation and destruction of wetlands while accommodating necessary economic development in a matter consistent with wetland preservation that is the stated duty of the Commission pursuant to Section 28.2.1301 of the Code. As such, in accordance with Section 28.2.13.13 of the Code, staff has no alternative than to recommend that the Commission reverse the Board's after-the-fact approval and deny the application. Staff believes this recommendation is further supported by the requirements of the Commission's own Wetland Mitigation Compensation Policy and Supplemental Guidelines. That's Regulation 4 VAC 20-390, etc., and the specific criteria therein, which states, and again I quote, in order for a proposal to be authorized to destroy wetlands and compensate for the wetland loss in some prescribed manner, the three criteria listed below must be met. If the proposal cannot meet one or more of these criteria, the activity shall be denied or must occur in areas apart from the wetlands. Since it should satisfy all three criteria, however, compensation for the wetlands loss is required. Since the proposed activity should stand on its own merits in the permit approval process, compensation should not be used to justify permit issuance. And the three criteria listed are, number one, all reasonable mitigative actions, including alternative siting, which would eliminate or minimize wetland loss or disturbance, must be incorporated into the proposal. Number two, the proposal must be clearly water-dependent in nature. And number three, the proposal must demonstrate clearly its need to be in the wetlands and its overwhelming public and private benefits. Furthermore, staff would recommend that the Commission direct the submittal of a restoration plan for the area impacted for review by our staff as well as the VIM staff within 30 days, and the removal of the unauthorized bulkhead and associated backfill from the impacted jurisdictional title wetland area within 90 days thereafter. I would be happy to try to answer any questions you may have. Go back to any slide.
Questions of Jay?
I've got one.
Dr. McConaughey?
Jay, do we know there's a bulkhead there by the pool? Do we have any information as to whether that was, how that was permitted? Because it looks like it's...
That was brought up during at least one of the hearings, and all I can tell you is staff at the city level is looking into it.
Both those pools, right?
Yeah.
Jay, just a couple questions. Make sure I've got this right. It's in print, but I'll make sure it's right. Get in there. Mr. Harvey said he was told by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers where to build his pier and that a city inspector told him that their permits for piers always included bulkheads?
That's correct. I would have to go back through the minutes. That may be worded a little differently, but that was stated in, I believe, both the CBPA hearing, at least one of the wetland hearings, that information was related to Mr. Harvey. What I can, by way of trying to clarify, the city, when they issue a building permit, I believe, and it may be termed differently, for a pier, on the form, the permit says pier/bulkhead. That's, if you get a pier, you get a pier/, that's the paper that it's on.
But the description, more accurately, indicates what's to be built, whether it's a pier or a bulkhead, because one's a dog, one's a cat.
If you go to item 3B61, that was the original application for the pier that we reviewed back in 96.
Let me get a crane.
Sorry about that. Not all of me.
Three.
And the letter from staff, 3B5C, you have inquired regarding a permit to construct a 280-foot-long private open pile pier. There's no mention of bulkhead either in the drawings or in the application.
Okay. The other question I've got, make sure that it's not lost in syntax. The board clearly felt that this structure would not have been approved as it currently exists had they had an opportunity to review an application prior to construction. Where does that line come from? Is it part of the minutes?
I would say look at item 3. Three A19, starting with Mrs. Hinch, which, like Dr. McConaughey, asked if the other bulkheads were legal. Staff stated she would investigate if the board desired. Chairman Lane asked, if we consider this as an application that came before us and it wasn't already there, which is to say you just brought to us an application for a bulkhead in that same area, Mr. Davis said he would not bring in an application like that. Chairman Lane continued on saying staff would advise to pull it back to the wetlands. Mr. Davis said he would have already counseled his client that he would need to avoid and minimize and what the impacts were all about. He said he wished, I don't have to read it for you, it's right there.
There. Further questions? Mr. Tankard.
Just briefly, if you would, Mr. Harvey, the third question, how the agenda was framed. I've read through these, but I'm still a little bit vague on that question and his idea of framing the agenda.
Right. That had to do with when their agenda for their meeting, again, it's a dual meeting. It's a wetland meeting slash CBPA meeting hearing. The way the items were ordered, staff's recommendation on the bulkhead was for denial and removal. If that were the case, there really wasn't a need to go to approval of the buffer behind the bulkhead because that was going to be removed. And his reasoning for wanting to change the format, it's probably better described by himself. And again, Ms. Sanford is here indicating that why staff did it the way they did it. But it had to do with the CBPA violation versus the wetland violation.
Okay. Further questions? Is the Wetlands Board represented?
I believe they are.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. My name's Dana Sanford. I'm an attorney with the city, Chesapeake City Attorney's Office. I serve as counsel to the Wetlands Board.
Nice to have you here, ma'am.
Thank you. And I want to also note that we have both our chair here, Mr. Jim Lane, who's sitting back there in the corner, and our vice chair, Ms. Ketchmark, also in the back row. And they're happy to answer any questions you have for them. But if I could take about 3 minutes and just summarize the board's position on this. And I think the legal framework is important because the after-the-fact application was considered in the context of a restoration hearing. The board had already found that a violation existed. They assessed a civil charge, which was paid by the applicant. And here the issue then was what to do about the bulkhead as it stood. And the commission, I know, is aware that under 28.2.13.17d of the Code of Virginia, a board or the commission may order restoration if it finds that restoration is necessary to recover lost resources or to prevent further damage to resources. And I think that this is where we sort of get into the nature of the wetlands, the integrity of the structure, and so forth. There were really 4 points that were key for the decision here, and I believe it's all supported by evidence in the record. First was the testimony of the applicant's consultant, Doug Davis, who's an environmental consultant of some experience, and I think who carries some credibility with the board. His comments were echoed by one of our board members, James Cahoon, who is also in the environmental consulting business. They both felt that the wetlands in which this bulkhead sat was Phragmites, which, while certainly wetlands, it was of lesser ecological value in the categories established by the commission. I think it was also stated in the record that if the bulkhead were removed, that in fact what would take hold would be the Phragmites, and in fact the scientists say and did say that over time this would result in the property or this area being converted to upland. So I think that was really key in terms of what would happen if the bulkhead was taken out. The second important point was this marsh, which of course protects the shoreline. If the application came in, the marsh would, I think, be a key point in resulting in denial of this bulkhead as a prospective application. But looking at it as it stood, the board felt that this was not a situation where there would be waves hitting the bulkhead, the wave energy being refracted to other properties, resulting in more damage to wetland by leaving it there. So I think that was one thing that's reflected in the record. The third point, again, the structural engineers certified to the satisfaction of the building official that the structure itself is safe, it is of sufficient integrity so that it's not going to be failing anytime soon, resulting in spillage into the wetlands. And the fourth item, as Mr. Woodward noted, there was a great deal of discussion about the relative benefits of having 1.5-to-1 compensation of Spartina in a wetlands bank versus, again, this Phragmites, which, according to testimony, would ultimately result in conversion of the land to uplands over a period of time. So we feel like in the context of a restoration hearing that the board considered the practicality, the benefit of restoring the land, what would happen over time, and whether the removal of the bulkhead was necessary to prevent further damage to resources. And we feel like within the confines of the statute, it was supported by the evidence in the record. And I'm here for questions. And again, Mr. Lane and Ms. Catchmark are here too, if you'd like to direct any questions directly to them.
Questions for counsel?
Yes, that one. Could you explain the detriment to the wetlands by having functional Phragmites versus this bulkhead?
No, sir, I'm not qualified to speak to that.
Okay. I mean, but was that brought up to I've heard people saying that, you know, that there's a problem with it, but I haven't heard exactly what the problem was. Is that something that you have heard in this discussion and brought to you in your attention?
Not framed that way, but again, Mr. Lane or Ms. Catchmark may be able to share their thoughts on that with you.
Or Mr. Varner or Dr. Parnell from VIMS as well.
Yeah, I figured I'd ask that too.
Okay. Thank
questions?
You.
I've got a couple questions. It seems to me, by virtue of the record, that what happened was someone went up there, built something without a permit. Then ex post facto, we start examining what's the best way of doing it to mitigating what occurred. Sure. And it troubles me that if you can get something done without oversight, then we'll go back and see how we can mitigate it one way or the other. And you get to a certain break point where if you have the resources, you can build it, go before certain oversight boards, and it troubles me that it's done and the board didn't say, you know, let's check with VIMS about, and I don't see that in the record, but maybe it's voluminous, as you can see. What can we do to restore this to the way that it should be? And I heard you mention the Phragmites issue, but best I understand, Phragmites can be treated and different types of alternate vegetation can be put in there. As you're familiar with the term stare decisis perspective, it bothers me that this sets a precedent where if you have two more down the way that go up and I don't mean this term in an appropriate way, and under the cover of darkness, that how are we going to handle the next one that's similarly situated in a Phragmites fringed marsh basin? My pier goes right across a mixture of stuff. And the other thing I don't quite understand is the discussion that a bulkhead comes with a pier. Can you shed a little light on that for me?
Well,
or do you have any direct knowledge of that? I don't mean to put you in a box, but I just wondered if you did, fine. If you don't,
well,
okay.
It's a true statement that when the city building department issued this permit, they actually did write pier bulkhead on it.
So one not being in the business may reasonably understand or deduce that one comes with the other.
Well,
if it were an person that didn't have knowledge in this business.
Yes, sir, and I think that was actually a consideration. It certainly was in the violation discussion, but it also, I think, spilled over into this restoration hearing because we did have board members who expressed some empathy with Mr. Harvey in terms of the fact that he did have the Army Corps come out. They did look at it. They did apparently establish where the end of the pier would go. We had a building permit issued erroneously to note a bulkhead on it, even though a bulkhead wasn't applied for. So there were a series of circumstances, I think, that the board was somewhat empathetic with the applicant. I don't think it was strictly a vote based on that. I think that was one of all these other pieces that resulted in the decision that they made.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fox has a question for you, counsel.
I'm just looking at the document here that 3B61, which I think is part of the application for the pier.
It is.
And I see the pier very clearly drawn there, but I don't see a bulkhead drawn at all. And so what the Corps of Engineers approved was apparently related to that drawing.
Yes, sir. That's true. Again, this was an argument raised by Mr. Harvey and supported by the building permit itself, which did say bulkhead. But certainly he never applied for a bulkhead permit, and that was not at least originally contemplated in the paperwork. So,
do we have the building permit in this stack of papers?
Yes, sir. It is there. And I'm going to rely on...
There's a couple references to building permit. Again, this is the package... that came with the letter that I inserted into your packet. What I'll do is I'll just
pull it up.
I'll just hand this out to you.
It'll be fine.
But it's not in this stack of
is this, that's right. Is this in the record? Was this in the record?
Thanks. I did not find that in the Wetlands Board hearing record. I believe it was in the Chesapeake Bay Act hearing record.
Is there a motion to open a record?
I move to open the record.
Motion made by Mr. Hollins, or second?
I'll second it.
Second by Dr. McConaughey. Further discussion? I'd like to open the record to see, look at the building permit to see, because I think that's what we're trying to get to. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Council. Further questions while Mr. Schick.
So was it brought to the board that he came in asking for a pier permit and walked out and said, oh, I've got a bonus. I got a bulkhead, too.
That was his testimony, yes, sir.
Okay.
Further questions of council? Thank you, ma'am. Is anyone here from the Wetlands Board that wishes to be heard? I guess the applicant's next call, correct?
Yes.
Applicant here or represented?
An existing deteriorated bulkhead.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is James Harvey III. I'm attorney for the applicant.
Okay.
And I want to...
Are you represented? Are you related?
Counsel for, yes, son.
Your son?
Yes.
Okay. Bridget.
Testifying as to facts?
Go ahead.
Are you going to be testifying as to facts?
No, I think I'm going to be presenting arguments as they were previously presented. And let me address the last issue of the board first. I had indeed sent a letter containing documents that had not been included from the various considerations of this board. This had been a matter considered over many months, and as has been stated before, in Chesapeake Bay Preservation Board is the same as the Wetlands Board. They considered this matter. They certainly had all of this information as a part of their consideration when we culminated in March. And so I felt it was appropriate that in addition to the records from the specific wetlands violations, they also had the record relating to the Chesapeake Bay Act, sure. When in fact city staff came and spoke about the no detriment to water quality posed by the structure. In addition, the record that had all of the applications for the building permit placard, which stated pier and bulkhead, and the information that they had had, including an email from the city staff saying that the permit had been inadvertently issued without proper authority. So my point, and I think as been stated by counsel for the city, was that the board addressed this issue in detail. They did find sympathy with this applicant because there had, in fact, been confusion that ranged all through the city. There had been confusion on the permits as to what was permitted. This applicant thought he did have a permit. He thought of that because of a conversation he had with the building inspector on the site, who said he could build a bulkhead in that location. That was part of the record. Whether or not, you know, we know now in fact that that's not going to happen, but I do want to address your concern in a minute. Secondly, when he walked the ground with the Army Corps of Engineers, they pointed towards the toe of the slope, saying this is where the pier can end. And in his mind, in addition, a fact that has not been brought up at this point, but was, I think, crucial before the Wetlands Board hearing, was that there had been construction debris and fill placed in that location before the applicant had purchased the property. There was sand and concrete and brick in this area. It had seemed to be filled area. So to a person who's not experienced with all of these areas, this did, by all appearances, appear as an upland fill type area that would not be subject to the jurisdiction. So that makes sense, because you wouldn't build a retaining wall and step down into marsh to step onto the permitted pier. The permitted pier would indicate where it is now dry enough to move out of the Army Corps' jurisdiction. And so all those confluences of facts led to this specific discussion, and I think this goes to your issue about stare decisis, about any precedential value. I would also caution the board, the Wetlands Board made a civil charge that was accepted by the applicant. That, A, is a deterrent to any other person coming along. And, B, if you were, you know, to go ahead with this process in the future and you had to purchase the mitigation banks, probably the most economical situation to most homeowners would not be to incur those costs. So I think already built into this situation is fairly unique. It's not going to come back and, as you say, help people by the cover of darkness. I think the facts presented to the board was that's not what was going on here. There was an honest misunderstanding by a citizen, and he went and he got all the permits he thought were necessary. When more was required, he took what actions he could. He engaged those experts to show what is going on this property. And so then I wanted to take that opportunity to then also say that the board, the board standard, I think, is described in 28.2.1308, and it provides the clearest guidance here. And it says the following standard shall apply to the use and development of wetlands and shall be considered in the determination of whether any permit required by this chapter should be granted or denied. And it said, one, wetlands of primary ecological significance shall not be altered so that ecological systems in the wetlands are unreasonably disturbed. And two, development in Tidewater, Virginia, to the maximum extent practical, shall be concentrated in wetlands of lesser ecological significance. And thirdly, which is under C2 of that statute, when mitigation bank credits are used, the bank is ecologically preferable to practicable on-site and off-site mitigation options. Those are all the standards that I believe that the board considered. They discussed the matter in detail. I would differ with what the staff's recommendation. The staff said that there was no consideration of removal of the structure. There was, in fact, repeated consideration of that over many months coming before the board. And they decided at the end of the day that because of the facts that you've previously heard, because there would also be no detriment to the water quality in this area by the structure remaining where it was with the filter fabrics in place, that it didn't make sense to remove it. And I want to address that briefly. I think VIMS did submit a report that, you know, the Wetlands Board did seek that assistance, but I think there was also conflicting testimony, and the board sided mainly with the applicant based on the facts that were presented, and Mr. Davis is here to, I think, help answer the question about the Spartina versus the Phragmites marshes in this area, that in fact what was going to result. Well, first off, the initial VIMS report indicated that this was a type 12 mixed community, which would have high ecological significance. The evidence presented, including by these photographs, and was repeatedly considered by the board, was that it was not in fact a type 12, but it was of one of the lowest ecological significance in the area, type 7 or a type 8, pure Phragmites, not mixed area. And that was also demonstrated, I think, by the slideshow you saw up close of Phragmites Marsh. And I think, as Mr. Woodward said, saying it was exclusively Phragmites. He said that here before the commission today. And Mr. Davis explained, which was seconded by Mr. Cahoon, a member of the board, who's also knowledgeable, that Phragmites Marsh will eventually create upland fill. And that's all it would do, and that there would be no sense. And I think the quote was, with the project, we get an alterniflora marsh, and we get a functional BMP. Without the project, if it is restored, we can get a Phragmites Marsh, and that furthermore, because of the construction debris that was in this area, that would only enhance the development of the Phragmites, and that would be questionable. Several members of the board then questioned whether any restoration process would be effective, given the history of this particular piece of land and the wide band of Phragmites that borders all the properties. Secondly, the VIMS report had also said that there were no other bulkheads or structure treatments on the adjacent properties. The board took that into consideration, noticed that there was, and that, in fact, when you overlaid the where the wetlands jurisdiction would end, that pool on the what would be the east end of the photograph you're now looking at would appear, that structure would also infringe. Mr. Harvey had spoken that he had spoken with that individual who did, in fact, have a proper permit for that structure, and so it appeared consistent with the remainder of the areas. Thirdly, the VIMS report stated that the vertical structure of the bulkhead may also affect adjacent properties through the deflection and concentration of wave energy during extreme high tide events and storms. This was also contradicted by the testimony of Mr. Bradford, Mr. Davis, and then by the board members. Mr. Cahoon did not find that to be credible, given the expanse of the marsh that would deflect wave energy, the height of the structure itself. If there were a high tide, it wouldn't be deflecting any wave energy because simply the waves would be riding over top of the structure at that point. Finally, the VIMS report concluded that the area now impacted could be restored with success if the regulatory authorities require it. This was directly contradicted again by Mr. Davis, was the opposite conclusion reached by a clear majority of the board members. They considered what would happen. Board member Midget said, we will be getting higher quality wetlands that would be created otherwise. Mr. Ottinger stated that he thought it was very difficult to recreate any positive wetlands in this area.
Councilor, not to interrupt, but not being familiar with the expertise of your wetlands board, do they have the same amount of level of expertise as professionals at VIMS do pertaining to this, to make comments on this?
I would certainly say Mr. Cahoon does. He's in the same business as Mr. Davis, who will address you briefly. They addressed this, and I can tell you that we attended at least 5 months of meetings, and these issues of the type of wetlands impacted by various applicants were each addressed, and the board seemed knowledgeable, certainly, as to the benefits and detriments of the different types.
Because, as you know, VIMS is our scientific representative.
I understand. But I would say that this city board had taken this into consideration, its past considerations, and were certainly knowledgeable, and specifically on this property, dealing with it with over 4 months, were particularly knowledgeable about what the impacts were.
Thank you.
Finally, Mr. Cahoon, who I just spoke about, I think the quote that's in the minutes says, Mr. Davis is correct. Based upon the existing conditions around the pier, it is very likely a frag marsh. If we were to restore the property, there is no doubt it is frag. If we were to restore it slightly upland, it would probably be frag. More of a benefit is the Spartina alterniflora in the mitigation bank. I think board member Catchmark also said that she sided with the information presented by the applicant instead of VIMS. And Mr. Midget also agreed that it seemed apparent that the Army Corps had indicated where the pier should end, and that seemed to be a logical place based on the conditions on the ground as to where the wetlands truly were impacted. And then finally, I think they took into consideration what was the appropriate mitigation value. As was stated, there was a motion for a higher, there was a proffer for a lower, and they reached something in the middle, and that was certainly within their jurisdiction. So if we go back to the legal standard, it was not, I think they had sufficient grounds to find that this was not a wetlands of primary ecological significance. They considered the unreasonableness of the disturbance and had addressed that through the permitting process and through the civil charge. and they took the practical considerations of what would happen to this property if you were to call it removed. It wasn't going to benefit the water quality any more than what was existing, and finally found that the mitigation bank was preferable to any on-site options that were available. And so from our position, the board did in fact meet its burden for your consideration here today, that it applied the standards and it reached a conclusion. They may not agree with your staff's conclusions, but they are entitled to some deference in reaching that. And I ask that Mr. Davis just come forward and explain maybe the technical differences here on the frag mark.
I do have one question.
Questions, yes. Counsel? Mr. Schick.
Are you telling me that the Army Corps of Engineers cut his pier short and said it had to end at a certain point? Was his drawing drawn and the drawing showed that the pier was a certain distance, and that's where that distance comes
from? The testimony was that the Army Corps walked the ground and placed a stake and said your pier can start here. And said this is where your pier can start. And that was consistent with what the permit had shown, only because the permit was reflecting what were the conditions on the ground, that there was existing fill in this area that predated the homeowner moving in there. And so what I would say is that the line of where the hardwood preserve was arbitrary with reference to this single property as reflected by the conditions on the ground.
And nobody questioned that the Army Corps of Engineers has no authority on upland facility of where a pier can start and stop?
No, I mean, I think the point being, this is where the toe of the slope is,
right?
And so he moved forward, he put his pier there. When he then went forward constructing the bulkhead that he thought he was authorized to do, even though he was not, it was only logical to have it in that same location where there appeared to be fill, where there didn't appear to be impacting, and where you wouldn't step off of a structure and theoretically through a marsh to then step onto a pier. And so I'm just saying that in those facts, in this circumstance, it made sense. And I know there was a question about the agenda. I don't think it really – I'll be happy to address that issue, but I don't think it actually impacts what the commission is here before on.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up question. You referred us to Statute 28.2-1308 and the standards that the board was under when it made its decision. And our staff in their analysis has also referred us to our mitigation compensation policy and guidelines, which are developed under 28.2-1301. And those are to be taken into account as well. And it does appear that mitigation, to a large degree, was used to justify the final decision of the board. And staff has referred us to those guidelines, which indicate that all three conditions must be met in satisfying a permit. And that is, one, that all reasonable mitigative actions, including alternate siting, which would eliminate or minimize wetlands loss, be incorporated in the proposal, that the proposal be clearly water-dependent in nature, or third, that the proposal must demonstrate clearly its need to be in the wetlands and its overwhelming public and private benefits. And it seems that this project doesn't meet any of those three criteria that are required, and I would just ask for your response to that.
Well, my first response is that the statute does take precedence over any regulations, and I think 1308 is the one that clearly states the following standards shall apply to the use and development of wetlands. I would say, B, that the board's decision was not just mitigation-driven. It was driven with, as is stated in 1308, the unreasonable disturbance of wetlands, and it made that conclusion based on, and I think, as counsel has said, there was sympathy here that this wasn't unreasonable given the circumstances, and B, the practical considerations that are also in 1308 and as are stated in the regulations, that it wasn't practical to restore wetlands in this site given what would occur, and you would be gaining a lower quality wetlands than what could otherwise be provided that would just result in upland fill over a larger amount of time. And so I think the board, they considered what are the relevant facts for it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Fox?
I just want to point out here, I'm reading the City of Chesapeake building permit. And it says, I understand this permit is granted only for the work shown on the plans and described in the application. The plans do not show a bulkhead. Reading further down, it says type of work, pier and bulkhead, but then it says description, pier, does not mention bulkhead. So I believe what this is saying is that the type of work falls into the category of piers and bulkhead. But what was approved was actually a pier only.
And I don't think there's any disagreement, and that's why, in fact, the civil charge was assessed by the board for that. But I think the board also expressed its understanding of the confusion that was created, also in evidence, and as I had forwarded to your staff, was the placard or the printout for the placard that also says pier/bulkhead. The inspector's notes say pier/bulkhead. And, yes, it probably does end up being a description of the class of work instead of the individual ones. But I think the board took note of an honest misunderstanding that occurred in this circumstance. And as a result, a civil charge was assessed and paid voluntarily by the applicant as a result of that portion. And the question was, what do they do now with this structure?
Further questions? What type of surface is on that top of that bulkhead?
The fully permeable synthetic turf. So four engineers and the city staff found that it served as a functional BMP that did not degrade water quality in the area, but that wasn't a matter for the wetlands. It was more an issue for the CBPA violation.
So was anything planted there prior to the placement of this artificial material?
No, nothing was growing in this area. In fact, trees had been dying in that area prior to it. And so from his perspective, it's the only way to maintain the area.
Do you know when the discussion pertaining to placing a putting cup came up in the
putting cup?
Hole?
There's a hole in
putting green?
Yes. Okay.
I'm not a golfer, but what is the cup? Is there a cup in there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is.
When did that discussion come up as to, did the city authorize?
No, that's what started with the Chesapeake Bay violation. That's part of and that was resolved by the city as part of the Chesapeake Bay violation part, and that originated approximately 1 year ago.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
So, I'd like to call Mr. Davis real quick.
You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, help you God.
I do.
You state your name, please. You represent.
Douglas Davis. I originally was prepared to discuss the issue of whether this site was primarily Phragmites or not, but I think that's been abundantly established that it was almost entirely Phragmites. There's one thing in the discussion in the months dealing with this with the Wetland Board that I think needs some clarification. The question was, how could you have a bulkhead when the drawings don't show a bulkhead? If anything, the wetland regulatory program can be confusing. I've been doing it for many, many years and been in meetings and watched homeowners almost glaze over when you have a half a dozen people describing their jurisdiction here, another one there, another one there, and another one there. From the beginning, the discussion of the Corps of Engineers coming out to apparently the edge of that fill and saying, I think he probably said, this is the edge of our jurisdiction where we have jurisdiction over your pier. It was heard, I believe, as this is where your pier can begin. Now, if indeed the perception was this is the edge of the jurisdiction and this is where your pier can begin, then a bulkhead behind that would be outside wetland jurisdiction and no permit would be required.
Can I ask you?
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't a building permit be required for that and drawings for that done from the city?
I assume so, yes.
Okay.
That was Mr. Fox for the record.
Right. So I'll stand by for any other questions regarding Phragmites or anything else.
Mr. Fox.
No.
I'm sorry, Mr. Schick.
Can you explain to us how functional Phragmites marsh turn into solid upland fill?
Very slowly. Phragmites, one of the reasons Phragmites grows so well in sandy soils, dredge spoil, and disturbed areas is it has a lot of silica in its leaves, and it uses that silica to grow. Consequently, the leaves don't deteriorate. They stay leaves for many, many years. In addition, you've all seen the rhizomes of Phragmites, the underground roots and stems. Sometimes they're, often they're big as your finger, sometimes bigger than that. With the accumulation of these silicon-laden leaves and stems of Phragmites, with the rhizomes taking up volume, essentially it just grows itself up out of wetland board jurisdiction. The question of would this be a Phragmites marsh? Outside of exceptional effort along that entire shoreline, this site is certain to be a Phragmites marsh if it was restored. And that's what that's the testimony in front of the board, and I'm here to support that again.
Thank you. Further comments or questions? Thank you, sir.
I have one question.
Mr. McCluskey. Yes, sir.
Mr. Davis, how about giving a brief history or background? I believe you were with the Corps of Engineers in this same format, weren't you?
Yes, sir. I was with the Corps as a wetland scientist, environmental scientist from many, many years ago, from the 80s. Before that, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the 70s.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. You can be seated. Is anyone else here on behalf of the applicant wish to be heard? Opposition?
Yes, Mr.
James?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, sir.
Members of the board.
Solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
State your name, please. Who you represent, Mr. James?
My name is Ellis W. James. I reside at 2021 Kenlake Place in the city of Norfolk. And as each of you knows, I am a Sierra Club observer, both here at VMRC meetings as also at many Wetlands Board meetings across Hampton Roads. The staff has given you an excellent review of what this situation is. And I don't think that I need to spend a lot of time in trying to direct your attention to all of that. I find it interesting that fear of the Phragmites has become the diversion in this situation as it relates to the specific matters that were heard by the Chesapeake Wetlands Board. There is, in my mind, a very, very strong argument that has been made both by the staff in Chesapeake as well as your staff here. This particular situation I referred to when I objected to this at the Wetlands Board meeting, I deliberately used the word egregious. I view this particular situation as an egregious violation of what you, the commissioners, are required to protect for us here in the Commonwealth. In this particular situation, both your staff and the Wetlands Board staff have strongly addressed these issues of the violations, and they have provided the support and the arguments. Your own guidelines speak very strongly to it, and I would simply close my remarks by urging you to support your staff and deal with this and require the restoration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Parnell, a couple questions for you.
Lyle Vernell, Dems.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
As far as restoration is concerned, you've heard what's been said. You're our scientific advisors. I want your candid and educated opinion as to the restoration potential for this specific project.
Well, I would agree that Phragmites is a very tough customer. It's very stubborn. However, it is not without its own inherent value. It's part of your guidelines, and that was a wetland. Our staff scientists had called that brackish water mixed. Forensic wetland science is very difficult, and if something is under dirt, it's hard to tell what was there, or turf, or whatever is there now. We've unfortunately had more experience with this over our years than we really like to, but the way that is done at Vins is maybe we'll educate you on that, we'll help you. We look at the surrounding area, what is inherent on the shorelines adjacent, what might have been in an area that was filled that we were looking at after the fact. Of course, if there's any low-level or very on-site photography, that would be very good, but you're making your best guesstimate. Anyone is at this point because it's not a wetland anymore. But I did notice in the slides and such that there's a few plants coming up. It looks like some Baccharis or Iva or Morica that may be legacy plants around the bulkhead, especially on upland margins. You can have these wetland plants that do make it a brackish water mix. Brackish water mix is generally more than one or two specific plants in a wetland. And it probably was a majority or most all Phragmites, but that right now is just based on what is there now. But looking at the some of the stuff that we see on the upland margin and what may be legacy plants coming back up around the area, you probably could have had some shrubs in the area that are also very valuable in wetlands. So as for the restoration, it's a very invasive species, Phragmites is, and unless you know, shrubs may work on the upland margin, depending upon if it was graded to the right elevations and such. But and as for the progradation around the Phragmites, yes, I do agree, and it's very well known that Phragmites does prograde land, but it's a very complex question whether that can outrun sea level rise in this area also. So I can't say that would be the case anywhere in Tidewater right now, that would occur. So
is it better left alone or better to be restored?
That's not my question to answer. That's a policy question that's very complex. And you agreed, from a value perspective, alternate flora, it can be more valuable depending on what's landscape situation than Phragmites, whether there was some wax myrtles and groundsel trees in the area. That's a difficult question to answer in such a small area as this. If you did restore it, if you did require restoration, there could be some species put in. But there's no doubt in my mind that at least a part of that would be reinvaded by the Phragmites coming in. That's a large maintenance issue. Also, you've got to continue
as well
to
as some
that.
Of the dirt possibly washing back or washing away or causing any water quality degradation. Do you have any concern about that?
Well, that
it's a small area. I realize, and it's upland, but is
well,
any,
that's true, and it looks. The better vegetated the buffer is, that's why we have the Preservation Act.
Okay. Any questions of Lyle? Mr. Tankard.
With the bulkhead, Lyle, it seems to me there is some disadvantages as opposed to a naturally sloping in that time of storm surge. Do you agree with that?
There are very few times in a marine environment when a vertical face, hard vertical face, is advantageous. From the perspective of the adjacent wetlands, yes. I mean, it's hard to tell the duration of a storm, the direction of the wave energy. It is far back, however. It's far back. You have a large marsh in front of it that would abate some of the wave energy.
Mr. Tankard.
So as a follow-up question, you would say then that Phragmites is preferable to a bulkhead in general?
Well, Phragmites is very good at erosion control in and of itself, and depending upon the slope or the grade of the upland, yes. I mean, I don't know that there was an erosion problem there in the first place. That's not been determined.
Mr. Schick.
As far as functionality, and of the system, would you say that what is in place would not be as advantageous to the functionality of what wetlands do versus having the Phragmites there? Because supposedly this surface is pervious and does filter for flood water, that type of thing.
Well, that's not a very easy question to answer, of course, but it was wanted to be a wetland. It was a wetland because it wanted to be a wetland. We're not certain that there was any problems there before. There may have been a very nice buffer and a large marsh in front to help with runoff. There may not have been any erosion problems at the site. So, and if there were shrubs, those are very good for treating runoff from uplands in that area. Justification for the Bay Act.
Thank you, Lyle.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Fox.
May I ask a question of counsel?
Yes, sir.
Josephson, staff is recommending that we pay attention to 28.2.1301 and of course 28.2.1313, which gives our rights and so forth. But staff is also encouraging us to pay attention to our regulation 4 VAC 20-390-10. And counsel for the applicant is suggesting that we pay attention to 28.2.1308. What should we pay attention to here? I guess it's a question, because if we pay attention to
I understand your question.
The regulation.
I understand.
It's very
first
clear.
First of all, the commission is authorized to develop regulations for wetland guidelines and regulations under its habitat authority. And so you've got a statute that authorizes regulations. I would point to 1301, among other things, as authorizing that, especially 1301D. And you do want to consider 1308, but the Wetlands Board is operating under the zoning ordinance, which is contained in 28.2-1302. And the zoning ordinance in section 10B says if all of these factors are met, then you grant the permit. Now, I'm a little confused here because my understanding from the staff briefing is that this is a request for an after-the-fact permit. And on the other hand, counsel for the Wetlands Board, whether it's a matter of perspective or whether it's actually treated as a restoration hearing, I'm not sure. But if the real nature of this proceeding is to consider the granting of a permit before or after the fact, then it seems to me that the conditions and requirements set forth in the zoning ordinance for granting a permit are what you would be looking to. And Section 10B of the zoning ordinance says shall grant if all the following criteria are met. Number one, anticipated public and private benefit exceeds anticipated public and private detriment. Number two, conforms with 28.2-1308 standards and wetlands guidelines. Number three, the activity does not violate the purposes and intent of Chapter 13, Title 28.2. And it seems to me you take into account the general purposes and intent of Chapter 13, 28.2, and I leave that up to you. But Section 10C of the zoning ordinance then goes on to say, shall deny if any of the criteria in subsection B are not 10B are not met. So I think that's the legal framework for a grant or denial of a permit by a local wetlands board. Now, I leave it up to you as to how you want to treat this as a after-the-fact permit or a restoration-type hearing under the subsequent statute that was cited by counsel.
I believe it's clear that it's an after-the-fact request, after-the-fact permit. Restoration, to some extent, has already been undertaken, or at least consideration thereof, mitigation, whatever, by the city. Matters before the commission for discussion and action. Mr. Schick.
I agree with the chair's comments about precedent setting. And you know, when people want to build pools, putting greens, tennis courts, gazebo houses, you know, any of these types of structures, sometimes the cost of doing business is the cost of doing business, whether you're paying the contractor or whether you're paying fines. And not to say that this gentleman purposefully plotted out this web so he could get his putting green. We'll never know that. But it is clear that the destruction of functional wetlands, whether it be Phragmites or not, has occurred, and these criteria for destruction of wetlands have not been met. So I don't see where we can you know, uphold the wetlands hearings.
Is that a motion?
Yes, it is.
Motion made by Mr. Schick to overturn the Wetlands Board decision. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Fox. Further discussion? Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard a number of arguments, I guess, in support today of the Wetlands Board decision. And as we look through what we have to consider, it seems that the under 28.2-1308, which the applicant's counsel presented to us, it suggests that wetlands should not be unreasonably disturbed. I think also, if you look in 28.2-1302, subsection 9, it says, under section D, 9, it says, in fulfilling its responsibilities under this ordinance, the board shall preserve and prevent the despoliation and destruction of wetlands within its jurisdiction while accommodating necessary economic development in a manner consistent with wetlands preservation. And to that same point, I think staff has appropriately pointed out that we consider the guidelines. And it does appear that a combination of mitigation, together with some of the confusion perhaps surrounding the application, were brought together to justify the retention of the structure. And I think on balance, the evidence doesn't support that decision. I think as staff has pointed out in their analysis under 28.2-1313, we are to modify, remand, or reverse if they either failed to fulfill their responsibilities under the zoning ordinance, under the wetlands ordinance, which is number one, or number 2E, if the evidence, if the decision is unsupported by the evidence on the record considered as a whole, then we are to modify, remand, or reverse. And I think it would be appropriate to reverse. And I would just ask that we perhaps modify the recommendation. They've only been given 30 days to develop a restoration plan. I would suggest that we make that 60 and allow them 180 days to remove the structure since it is fairly substantial.
Is that acceptable to the maker of the motion? Second by Mr. Schick?
Yes.
Further discussion? My only comment is, contained in the summary recommendation, the board clearly felt that this structure would not have been approved as it currently exists if they had an opportunity to review an application prior to construction. Well, in all due respect, and I don't know how it got there, I don't think we can allow the placement of these type of structures in areas of our jurisdiction. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much for your presentation. Mr. Roars, can you please enlighten?
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity. I wasn't present when the citizen spoke, so I don't know exactly what she said, but if she had indicated that the city was requesting or supported...
Steve.
Whoa!